So we're back in Acts, and this is the third part of this little trilogy, as we've called it grandly, in Acts 15. Part one was the first part of Acts 15, that council about whether people who became Christians from a Gentile background need to be circumcised. Now, if you weren't here, that might sound like an obscure issue, but what was at stake was the gospel. We called that sermon the truth that saves. When you start to say there's something that you need to do in order to be saved by God, that completely changes the whole Christian message. It distorts it. It ruins it. That was part one. Part two was the letter then that council wrote to the churches to reassure Christians from a non-Jewish background they don't need to get circumcised, but also to encourage them to exercise their freedom in a way that allowed them to still spend time with Jewish Christians. They didn't want to end up with kind of Jewish churches and non-Jewish churches, Gentile churches. And there's one church, one Lord, one gospel. And then today in part three, we see what happens as that letter is taken around to the churches who need to hear it. What's interesting, though, is that although Luke, the writer of Acts, does tell us how the letter is received. So that's kind of going on in verse 41, isn't it? At the end of last verse of chapter 15, and then in verses 4 and 5. That's going on in the background. The letter's traveling around and the people are receiving it. What's interesting is that actually the kind of main action is kind of these subplots, really, the things that happen as the letter's going. In these verses, I think, you might think that Paul's making a mountain out of a molehill at one point, but you could also say at another point that he's making a molehill out of a mountain. Let me explain what I mean. I've got a picture of a mountain. Yes, it's there. You know what a mountain looks like. Making a mountain out of a molehill is when someone takes something that actually is just a little issue and turns it into a big issue, right? You know someone who's done that to you. So let me explain what I mean about Paul. In the first part, Paul's making a big thing out of a little thing. So back in verse 2 of the chapter, there was an argument going on, wasn't there? Paul and Barnabas had a serious argument. At that point, they were both on the same side of the argument. And they were arguing with these people who come to town and said, if you want to be a Christian, you've got to become a Jew. Unless you're circumcised, you can't be saved. But now in verse 39, they're arguing again. But now they're arguing with one another. And they're arguing over what seems to be a much more trivial thing. Who they take with them on their mission trip. Is that really worth falling out about? Or is Paul making a mountain out of a molehill? Then in the second part of our reading, at the beginning of chapter 16, Paul circumcised Timothy. Which seems strange, doesn't it? Given that the reason he was in town was to deliver this letter that says you don't need to get circumcised. You would think this was kind of a big deal. But Paul doesn't make a big thing of it. This time he's making a big thing seemingly into a little thing. What was a big issue a few verses ago, now, well, it doesn't seem to matter anymore. So what's going on here on this journey? And what difference does it make for us? Let's have a closer look. First, let's look at those last few verses at the end of chapter 15, where Paul is in conflict with Barnabas. It's going to teach us some things about conflict between Christians. If you search Barnabas, his name on a Bible search thing, you kind of get Barnabas' history, and most of it's in Acts, actually. Paul and Barnabas have been friends ever since just after Paul became a Christian in Acts chapter 9. It was Barnabas who introduced Paul to the church in Jerusalem and kind of told them that he was all right. They're a preaching dream team. They've traveled around preaching together. They're travel buddies. They travel in chapters 11 and 12. At the beginning of chapter 13, the church in Antioch send them off together on their first mission trip. And in this chapter, they've been teamed up again to go from Antioch back to Jerusalem, and then Jerusalem back to Antioch, and further on with a decision from Jerusalem. So now Paul suggests they should go back. go back and visit the believers in the towns they'd visited on their mission trip. So we could get a map up for this bit. So the blue line is the kind of trip they did on the way out last time, and the red arrow is the line they get back, they do on the way back. And so Paul says, let's go back and visit the believers in the towns. He wants to see how they're doing. And no doubt he also wants to deliver the letter from Jerusalem. And in case the teaching that came to Antioch, that Christians need to be circumcised, is kind of carried on round. That's a great idea, says Barnabas. Let's take John. And you can imagine Paul's eyes narrowing. Yeah, you mean John? You mean Mark? Barnabas nods enthusiastically. Yeah, it'd be good for him. Paul really isn't sure, but you remember what happened, don't you? Acts 13 says that John, also known as Mark, people who write books about Acts call him John Mark, so let's call him John Mark. He travelled with Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey to Cyprus, that first blue arrow, where Barnabas is from, and into Perga in Pamphylia. But that was it. He didn't go any further with them. Acts 13 verse 13 just says, John left them to return to Jerusalem, no drama. But Paul didn't remember it in quite such a neutral way. Verse 38 in our passage says, Paul did not think it was wise to take him because he had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not continued with them in the work. The way Paul saw it, John Mark was a quitter. Taking him again was a risk. He wasn't reliable. Now, we don't know how the argument went between Paul and Barnabas. We don't know Barnabas' side of the argument. We know that when we're first introduced to Barnabas back in Acts 4, we find out that Barnabas actually isn't his real name. He's really called Joseph. Barnabas is a name that his Christian friends have given him, and it means son of encouragement. So it can't be fitting that Barnabas wants to give John Mark a second chance. You know, we're saved by grace. We live by grace. We serve by grace. I just want to show John Mark some grace. Come on, if he wants to come, let's take him. Give him a second chance. We know that Paul didn't think that way. He might have said, you know, I believe in grace as much as anyone. God gives us so much more than we deserve, but I don't want to jeopardize this trip. There's so much at stake here. I want as many people as possible to hear the message of grace. So if we take John Mark, we pay his expenses. Who's to say that he doesn't quit again? So they couldn't agree. Let's be clear about what they were disagreeing about. They're not disagreeing about the gospel. It's not about how to get saved or whether John Mark is really a Christian or not. It's just about whether it's wise to take him. Barnabas wants to prioritize one individual, showing them grace. Paul wants to prioritize the mission, taking the message of grace to the world. Which one's right? Well, I don't think that's the point, probably. Luke doesn't seem to take sides. It doesn't seem that there's one person who's wrong and one person who's right. What Luke does show us is that the conflict happens. And he also shows us that there's good that comes out of it. So verse 39 says, they had such a sharp disagreement, they parted company. Barnabas took Mark and sailed for Cyprus, where the first missionary journey had started. It's where Barnabas was from. But Paul chose Silas and left, commended by the believers to the grace of the Lord. Silas was one of the men that the Jerusalem church had sent with Paul and Barnabas and the letter to kind of tell the church in Antioch what the letter said. Paul had obviously been impressed by the way he'd ministered to the church in Antioch, so off they went together. I'm sure this hadn't been an easy time for the Antioch church. Maybe some of them agreed with Paul and some of them agreed with Barnabas. It was hard to see them disagreeing like this. But there's no sign that they divided over it. And they kept supporting Barnabas and Paul. It says they commended them to the grace of the Lord. Before there was one mission team, now there are two. Isn't God kind, even when his people can't agree? Well, we'll hear more later in the series when we get to it again in Acts about how they go back to Antioch and they receive a warm welcome. And if you read on in the New Testament, in three of Paul's letters, he writes about John Mark and he is really warm about him. He commends him. He says he's his fellow worker, someone who's very useful to him in his ministry. God gave him a second chance. And it seems to be that actually John Mark proved to be a faithful gospel minister. So what can we take from all this? Well, here's the first thing I think we can take practically, that conflict is inevitable. Even between Christians, even in Christian ministry, conflict is inevitable. Some people say, I wish we were just like the church in Acts. And we could say, well, it depends which bit of Acts, doesn't it? There's some bits in Acts where the church looks amazing. I mean, look at Acts 2, where 3,000 are added to their number, and then they devote themselves to the apostles' teaching and to prayer and to the breaking of bread and to the fellowship and so on. But even the church in Acts is full of sinners. Conflict is inevitable in the church because Christians are sinners. It's the same still today. We're saved by grace and our sin doesn't define us anymore. Our identity now is that we're children of God, chosen and called and justified through faith in Jesus. But we still sin. We still get things wrong. Our minds are still distorted. And so are our lives until Jesus comes back. So there will be conflict in the church until that day. Conflict is inevitable because Christians are sinners. But not only that, conflict is inevitable because Christians are different. Now that's a good thing, isn't it? We have different personalities, different strengths, different blind spots. We come from different cultures. We have different backgrounds. We've had different experiences of church and of family and life. We're one in Christ. We're all equally part of God's family. But, well, we're different. Some of us would have been quicker to give John Mark a second chance, like Barnabas. Maybe others would have seen it as too high a risk. Some would like to see us as a church taking more risks for the sake of the gospel. Others would instinctively play it more safe. Some of us are 100% behind the distinctives that we have as Grace Church. Others have different convictions on some secondary things, and that's okay. Some of us are super keen for Grace Church to work towards being an independent church. Others are more cautious about that. Conflict isn't necessarily a bad thing. But when we disagree, it's an opportunity for grace. So here's the third thing about conflict. Conflict is an opportunity for grace. If we only ever spend time with people just like us, who love us perfectly, well, we'd sort of love one another, wouldn't we? But it wouldn't really cost us anything. When we find out that we disagree with one another, or we've got different expectations or different ideas about how to live together, when we bring up that difficult conversation that we need to have because of the thing that one of us said the other day that was out of line, when we walk towards conflict carefully, it's an opportunity to show grace to one another. Like God has shown us grace in Jesus. Undeserved love, costly love, cross-shaped love. Sometimes our instinct might be to run away from conflict. You know, if you were Paul, you would have just said, yeah, okay, let's do it. But mainly because you didn't want to have that argument. Maybe you prefer to avoid the elephant in the room. We don't like bringing something up that might lead to a difficult conversation. Paul walked towards conflict, didn't he? Jesus walked towards conflict in his life. He walked towards those who are in need, and it led him into conflict. he set his face towards Jerusalem, as it says in the Gospels, and the great conflict with sin and death. He did that to save us from the horrors of conflict with God because of our sin against him. Because Jesus loved us like that when we least deserved it, we can show love to one another when we're in conflict, when we disagree, when we're different. That doesn't mean we need to enjoy conflict. That's a different thing, isn't it? We need to recognize that we all handle conflict differently. Some of us rush into conflict like rhinos, apparently. Others are more like hedgehogs. We roll up and hide. I guess those aren't the only two options. And you know where you kind of stand on that. But conflict is an opportunity for grace. Because of Jesus, we don't need to avoid conflict. We can bring it up. We can listen. We can forgive. And we can learn from each other. Having said all of that, these verses also suggest that sometimes when conflict arises, separation is the only way forward. Paul and Barnabas' conflict leads to their separation. Is that a good thing? I think we want to say it's sad. It's a kind of last resort. But in God's grace, it comes to a good outcome. It might be that two Christians start a project together and they just find out they can't work together. They have different convictions. They have different ideas about the way forward. So they don't ignore it. They work it through and they come to the conclusion that it's just better that they separate and do two separate things. Like Paul and Barnabas, they go their separate ways. I guess what matters is how they part company. Can they disagree agreeably? You might think the other person is wrong, but that doesn't mean you have to criticize them to everyone you meet. Can they be at peace with one another? Sometimes separation is the only way forward. But we need to be careful with this, don't we? A church shouldn't just divide every time it disagrees about something. That's why it's important that we know what we're committing to when we commit to a church. Then, we're committed to one another. As a rule of thumb, we want to say we're committed. We don't separate lightly. There are other examples we could think about. I read a quote this week that I think is helpful to just bring up on this point. It says, in life, and certainly in the Christian life, the mark of real maturity is to escape the prison of self-absorption. I'll read it again. I think it's helpful to apply it to this thing about conflict. In life, and certainly in the Christian life, the mark of real maturity is to escape the prison of self-absorption. So when you disagree with someone, the self-absorbed person asks, why can't they just agree with me? Why can't we just do things my way? How can I do what's best for me? Whereas the mature Christian, because of Jesus, can say, might I be wrong here? Yeah. Am I a sinner? Yeah. Has Jesus died for me? Yes, he has. How can we do what's best for Jesus? What can we do that best serves the spread of the gospel? I think that's how Paul and Barnabas were both thinking. So that's conflict. Conflict, it's inevitable, and it's an opportunity for grace. Let's see what happens next in the first part of chapter 16. I've given this the heading, flexibility. Now, we've just seen that Paul wasn't willing to flex about taking John Mark. What happens next is that you see Paul being surprisingly flexible. Perhaps you come across someone who seems very strong in their faith, very strong in their Christian convictions, but then after a while you realize that they're just so inflexible. And they're kind of brittle. I used to be an engineer, a mechanical engineer, and one of the tests that we had to do was to test stuff as to how strong it was. And one of the ways you can test if something's strong is by a tensile test. You pull it really hard, basically, in a machine, and you see how much force you can apply until it snaps. And what's interesting is that different materials snap in a different way. In general, brittle materials aren't that strong, because what happens is they don't deform very much. They can't flex. And so when you pull them, they get to a certain point and then they just, boom, they snap. That was more of a sound of a brittle metal rather than glass or an icicle. But strong materials like steel, if you pull them really hard, they flex and they stretch. They can deal with a lot of flex before they break. And that ability to stretch is a sign of Christian maturity too. You're sure of what you believe, but you're not just brittle. You can be flexible. In fact, the skill is knowing when to be flexible and when to stand up for the thing that you believe in, the gospel. So let's see how that plays out in Paul. Barnabas and John Mark set off on their journey to Cyprus. And we've got a map again, where Matt and Hannah have just been on holiday, by the way. You can ask them about what it's like when they get back. And Paul and Silas set off in the other direction, not across the sea now for them. They go across land from Antioch and round that purple bit, through Tarsus, where Saul's from, and to Derbe, which isn't the same Derbe as in the Midlands. And then onwards. And they visited the churches they planted, and they got to Lystra. It says they were teaching the churches and strengthening them. They're delivering this letter. And there's this weird juxtaposition, isn't it? They're delivering this letter, says you don't need to get circumcised. Paul agreed with the letter. He'd argued for it. He'd traveled hundreds of miles from Antioch to Jerusalem and back again and then round to deliver its message. It was a big deal to him. And it was important news for the churches he was visiting. And then he met Timothy. Timothy was a Christian. He lived in Lystra. Presumably he'd been converted last time Paul was in town. And it looks like he showed potential as a Christian leader. The other members of his church and the church nearby in Iconium recommended him to Paul. And so Paul decides to invite him to join his mission team. But first he says, job requirement, you need to get circumcised, Timothy. So hold on a minute. One minute, Paul's reading the letter to the church in front of all of them. You don't need to get circumcised to be a Christian. The next minute, he's telling Timothy, you need to be circumcised to come and join my team. You know, one minute, he's saying, if you even say the C word near Paul, he'll be laying out his arguments for why circumcision isn't necessary. Next minute, it looks like the rules are different. It's no big deal. Timothy, can you just get circumcised, please? What's going on? Well, here's the thing about Timothy. Basically, he was mixed race. In that his mum was a Jew and his dad wasn't. His dad was a Greek. So Timothy, who kind of lived as a Jew by the looks of it, hadn't been circumcised when he was 8 days old like a good Jew. Presumably his dad had put his foot down and forbidden it. Now that was fine for being a Christian, but it meant that Jews wouldn't recognize him as a Jew. Now here's Paul's mission strategy. Every time he arrives in a new city, where does he go first? He goes to the synagogue, to the Jews. His mission is to the Gentiles, to the non-Jews. That's the mission that God's called him to and appointed him for. But he always starts with the Jews. Paul was a Jew. And as someone who was a very well-educated Jew, he'd be asked to teach in a synagogue. But not if Timothy was with him. If Timothy was part of his team, well, Timothy wouldn't be allowed to come into the synagogue. So he couldn't preach to the Jews. But not only that, they wouldn't listen to Paul. Because if he accepted someone on his team who'd kind of lived like a Jew but not been circumcised, from their point of view, Paul would be distorting the Jewish faith altogether. They wouldn't even listen to him. They'd assume that Paul had abandoned the Jewish faith or that he was teaching some dangerous anti-Jewish message. And so that's why Paul circumcised Timothy. Not so that Timothy could be a proper Christian, he was already that by trusting in Jesus, but that so that he could be an effective missionary to the Jews. It wasn't for salvation, It was for the sake of mission. Paul wanted to take the message to all people, to the Gentiles, but he didn't want to close the door for the Jews. So although the rule was you don't have to be circumcised, he was willing to be flexible. He wasn't fixed. Timothy was free not to get circumcised, but he was also free to get circumcised if he wanted to. Timothy used his freedom. It's all very well Paul being flexible. Timothy had to agree to it as well, didn't he? He had to be flexible. Not only flexible, Timothy had to be sacrificial. Now, there's a lesson for us there, actually, isn't there? Sometimes, for us, being sacrificial for the sake of mission is costly. You're free to live wherever you want. But perhaps you could choose to live somewhere where the gospel is most needed. You're free to spend your money however you want. Perhaps you could choose to spend your money for the sake of the gospel. Some of us have had surgery recently. I'm assuming here, but I reckon you had surgery because we needed it. And it was for our benefit. It'd be rare to go under the knife for someone else's sake. Perhaps if you're an organ donor, I suppose, if you donated a kidney. It would probably be then to a family member, wouldn't it? It would be someone you knew. What Timothy did was sacrificial. He was willing to undergo surgery of sorts so that he could be part of a mission team, so that he could reach people he'd never even met yet, so that he could serve Jews who didn't know about Jesus and wouldn't hear about Jesus if he didn't get circumcised. So it's a mistake to think that a mature Christian is always inflexible about the truth. The skill you need to learn is knowing when it's okay to flex. If someone disagrees with the gospel, then we stand firm, right? We don't give an inch. We're gentle and we're gracious and we're humble, but we don't budge on the truth. Like one of those school rulers, you know, when you snap it, bang it against the desk, it snaps. And we don't flex on the gospel. But on other issues, we're more like one of those kind of rulers that you can bend into a shape so that you can draw it. What's in view in these verses isn't agreeing with other Christians on secondary matters. We're not flexing here for that reason. But using our freedom in Christ for the sake of the lost. We need to have rock-solid convictions on the gospel, but we need to live them out in a way that flexes, like the bendy ruler. So let me just try and illustrate that. 2 weeks ago, we were thinking about using our freedom for the sake of other believers. So I might say I'm free to drink alcohol, but my brother in Christ struggles with drink, or is convinced that it's not right to drink it. So for his sake, when I'm with him, I won't drink. And maybe I'll keep my alcoholic drinks out of view. I'm free, but I use my freedom for the sake of my brother or sister in Christ. This week it's about using our freedom for the sake of someone who doesn't believe. So I've got friends who spend a significant proportion of their time and money at the pub. It's their entertainment and it's their social life. I'm free not to do that. I'm satisfied without it. But I might choose to go and have a drink at the pub. Have a regular time with them, because otherwise the people there might never hear about Jesus. You might say, well, that's inconsistent. You're drinking with them and then you're not drinking with him. But I think Paul would say, I'm being flexible for the sake of the gospel. And he might also want to say, by the way, I'm not drinking much. I'm not getting drunk. I'm not there to drink. I'm there to be a friend. I'm there for the gospel. So here's what Paul says in a letter later on, 1 Corinthians 9. I'm going to read a bit of a chunk, so if you wanted to turn to it, you could. This is about how Paul uses his freedom. And if you wanted to read the whole chapter later, that is basically what this whole chapter is about, 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And I'm going to read from verse 19. He says, though I am free and belong to no one, I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. And Timothy would say, yes, so did I. To those under the law, I became like one under the law. In other words, I do things like making sure I'm circumcised and eating certain foods. Though I myself am not under the law, but I do that so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, so to the Gentiles, I became like one not having the law. But then he says, though I'm not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law. In other words, I'm not just doing whatever I want. I'm doing what Jesus wants. But I do that so as to win those not having the law. To the weak I became weak to win the weak. I've become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. I became all things to all people. Now that comes with a cost, doesn't it? I wanted to just finish by sharing the story of James Hudson Taylor, who took a similar approach. In fact, of the kind of famous Christian missionaries, he was most like Paul in this respect, as far as I know. He was a Christian missionary when it was still quite unusual to be a Christian missionary. He was born in 1832. When he was a little kid, his dad would talk about China at the dinner table. Apparently, when he was five, he said, when I'm a man, I want to be a fireman. That's not what he said. When I'm a man, I mean to be a missionary and go to China. And so then as a young man, he said, I fear I cannot go on living unless I do something for China. He trained as a doctor because he thought that would be the most useful kind of thing to take with him, apart from the gospel. And eventually he set sail for China. In those days, Christian missionaries from Britain tended to kind of go to another country and build chapels just like the one they knew at home, and kind of set up pews, and then they'd put on chapel services where they sang hymns with the same tunes as they sang at home. And not Hudson Taylor. He was pretty radical in this regard, and other British people thought he was weird. So he got to China and he started dressing like Chinese people. And he grew his hair long, so that he could have a little ponytail like the other Chinese people he was with, and he grew his beards, so that he could be culturally like them. He went and spent time with them in the marketplace, and he learned their language, actually not just one dialect. He didn't just learn Mandarin. He could preach in five different Chinese dialects, and he would give out little tracts, basically, booklets with the gospel in their language. He presented the gospel in a Chinese way. It came at great personal cost to him. Being in China took its toll on his health. His first wife died of cholera. Not all of his children survived until adult age. But here's what Hudson Taylor said later on in his life. He said, if I had £1,000, China should have it. If I had 1,000 lives, China should have them. No, not China, but Christ. Can we do too much for him? Can we do enough for such a precious Saviour? Hudson Taylor didn't ask, what's best for me? Oh, can't they just think like me? Can't they just do what I want to do? Can't we just go my way? He didn't cling to his rights or use his freedom for himself. He asked, what's best for Jesus? How can as many people as possible hear the good news about Jesus? For him, that meant going to China. That might be the case for some of us. But God has called each of us to reach a specific group of people. Perhaps for you, it's the people you know already, the people you work with, the people you live amongst. Paul, Hudson Taylor, Jesus Christ himself, they gave themselves up for the sake of the many lost people in the world who need to know about him.